from Pacifica Radio in San Francisco. This is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, UFW President Teresa Romero joins us for an update on how the farm workers are doing in their fight to stay healthy in the age of 19. Also reining in Israel's uncontrolled proliferation of nuclear weapons. And that's Charlie Lang on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. And we are happy to welcome back to these airwaves Grant F. Smith. He is the director of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy. And we welcome you back, Grant Smith, to Flashpoints.
Hi, Dennis. Thanks for having me back on again.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Is it true that the U.S. foreign assistance is on track to give Israel something like $295 billion? Israel, little Israel?
That's true. What we do that the Congressional Research Service doesn't do is that we've adjusted to inflation all of the aid packages since 1948. And so it is just under $300 billion. But that only includes publicly known aid. So I always caution people to consider that there's a vast amount of covert foreign assistance that's delivered to Israel that has never been quantified to the public.
All right, well, let's do this. You've got a new piece. Biden could reverse six harmful Israeli policies. Let's go through those policies. Take us through, and then we'll circle back after you lay this out.
Sure. So we put out that, I guess you'd call it a listicle, on January 20th, 2021, during the inauguration, just as kind of a wish list for how we could regain some moral authority in Middle East foreign policy. And we made the following recommendations for Trump policies that Biden could and should immediately reverse. And of course, the first one was the moving of the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. You know, everyone probably who follows this saw the images of Ivanka and Jared Kushner alongside Secretary of the Treasury Steve Mnuchin celebrating with champagne the relocation, even as Palestinians were being gunned down during the Great March of Return demonstrations. And so, you know, this move was a long time in coming. The lobby basically started trying to get that to happen through the Jerusalem Embassy Act of 1995, but such recognition was always an executive prerogative, and that is something they finally got President Trump to do. But we recommend Biden could just as easily reverse the move and move it back. Of course, it would be to a more modest property since the residency was sold off and kind of a bridge-burning exercise. The second was to stop extorting Arab countries to recognize Israel through the so-called Abraham Accords. The U.S. has been delisting countries from terrorist watch lists and sanctions, such as Sudan. It's been recognizing illegal land seizures of Morocco and Western Sahara, offering weapons to UAE, all as carrots and sticks to gain immediate recognition by Arab dictatorships of Israeli diplomatic exchanges and recognizing Israel in terms of setting up peace agreements and diplomatic exchanges, trade, and travel. We've recommended, you know, stopping that since, number one, it's a misuse of all of these U.S. carrots and sticks, and it's also going to lead to chaos since these dictatorships, which had virtually no representation and legitimacy in their own countries, are governing over an Arab street or population that is violently, well, not violently, but demonstrably in polling in opposition to these moves. And so we would recommend that they not do that and start rolling that back. The second was following up on Desmond Tutu at the end of last year, recommended that the U.S. should come clean on Israel's nuclear weapons. Desmond Tutu even called upon Biden to stop obscuring the weapons, which really, in his view, allowed Israel to dictate terms to others and as sustaining a form of Israeli apartheid against Palestinians. Tutu is obviously a moral authority on that, and he recommended the U.S. uphold its own foreign aid law, clearly name Israel as a nuclear state, and encourage it to get into the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So that sounded like a really good policy. U.S. recognition of Golan Heights as part of Israel. There's a massive movement underway since March 25, 2019, when Donald Trump issued a presidential proclamation saying that Syrian Golan Heights are part of the state of Israel. This is a policy proclamation no other country recognized. The EU rejected it. The UN rejected it. But it's allowed the Israelis to accelerate the colonization and exploitation of the Golan, including not just wineries and tourism, but untapped energy resources. And we provided some links to the latest on that, which is sort of a greenwashing the occupation through the development of wind energy in our article. The last two are Israeli annexation of the West Bank. That's ongoing anyway, but the U.S. stopped short of formally getting ready to recognize that, if so declared by the Israelis, in favor of the so-called Abraham Accords, or rather shaking down Arab countries to recognize Israel. It's still ongoing, though, in a major embarrassment to Biden, his second President Biden. First, it was when he was vice president. The Israelis have announced more settlements. And so they're continuing with the project, even though the U.S. is supposedly in opposition to that. And then finally, assassination of foreign leaders. This doesn't get enough attention. Ron Bergman, who wrote the book Rise and Kill First about the Israeli assassination policy, really made a lot of waves, and I think didn't mean to do this, but he's clearly named the Israelis as a leading state sponsor of assassination of foreign political leaders. Well, the U.S. has gotten into that business again after it was supposedly banned after the 1975 Church Committee investigation uncovered a raft of CIA plots to kill foreign leaders. Now the U.S. has jumped into the business when it assassinated Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian general, at the Iraq airport. And it's the type of following Israel's lead that the United States definitely shouldn't be into. So we name those six policy reversals. And, of course, we're virtually upon hitting the send key to publish this, alerted to the fact that Anthony Blinken, the new Secretary of State for the Biden administration, has already said the U.S. is not going to do anything with the embassy location. So that one seems to be a wish that was just a little bit too far.
I believe he made a bizarre comment like that. You know, we'll use that or somebody working with him as a negotiating point. I don't know what they would be negotiating about. What?
Right.
But this kind of power and this ability for Israel to, for instance, be a obvious nuclear renegade allows them to play another role in this world. I think one of their main industries has become exporting repression. They demonstrate how they do it with the Palestinians, with equipment, with surveillance. The United States helps with advanced weaponry. But Israel sort of provides like mobile operations and really contracts with foreign countries to help suppress their own populations, right?
Sure. Some of their smartphone-based surveillance software has been pointed out to be used in all sorts of repressive regimes. And, of course, the NSO group and other unit 8200 intelligence professional firms that are out there running around selling all sorts of covert programs to the private market are active. So, yes, because the U.S. is subsidizing the purchase of all sorts of what you could call commodities, although I'm sure the people facing all of these wouldn't consider them commodities, but things like, you know, ammunition, arms, smart bombs, you know, all these conventional weapons, gasoline to fire up the Humvees and other vehicles, jet fuel. Because the U.S. taxpayer is providing all of that for free, not to mention advanced fighter jets, Israelis get to focus their military-industrial export complex on some of the highest-end niches in intelligence and surveillance that are absolutely being exported across the world. So it's an interesting way to look at it, that the American taxpayer is subsidizing that and allowing the Israelis to devote most of their own resources, again, to things like the nuclear programs and surveillance technology.
All right, and I want to come back to those nuclear programs, because clearly people talk about a non-nuclear Middle East, and people in the United States and disarmament people and all that stuff. And they can do that because they make believe Israel doesn't have a major store of dangerous nuclear weapons. But
right.
They do. Everybody knows they do. How does it happen? How can it be? Say a little bit about what we actually know about what they have and why we don't know more.
Sure. Well, Jimmy Carter became the first ex-president to disclose that he knew for a fact that they had 150 nuclear weapons at their disposal. In some lawsuits against the Department of Defense, we unearthed a Reagan-era assessment that revealed they had been working on hydrogen bombs and essentially converted all of the Atoms for Peace nuclear infrastructure that U.S. taxpayers gave the Israelis into weapons production facilities matching our own national laboratories. So they definitely have a nuclear weapons program, and it's widely believed by Jaynes and other military analysts that they've mounted a full triad of weapons that can be delivered by missiles, by their fighter bomber jets that we provide them with, and the Dolphin class submarines that the Germans have been giving Israel. So it really allows, and people were probably alarmed to hear that they were openly boasting about joint U.S.-Israeli maneuvers in the Persian Gulf during the end of the Trump administration. They really use it to threaten, cajole, and project power in a way that no other country of that size has ever been able to do. So it's for people in the United States, if you look at State Department spokespersons and high officials who have been asked point blank by alternative journalists, because mainstream journalists never do it, you know, tell us about the implications of the nuclear weapons program in Israel, they always dodge and maneuver and avoid the question. And that's because the U.S. has actually passed regulations by executive order that no contractor or government official can, upon fear of their job in criminal prosecution, ever talk about or release information about Israel's nuclear weapons program. So it makes the U.S. an international laughingstock in terms of nuclear non-proliferation efforts. Virtually as the U.S. was cajoling and signing other countries to join the NPT, the Israelis were beating down first JFK and then LBJ
who was really like silly putty in their hands, to, you know, not enforce and not try to use Salem Hawk missiles and Phantom jets as leverage to get them to sign the NPT. And, you know, just followed by years, decades of propaganda that they wouldn't introduce nuclear weapons into the region or conduct tests, both of which they've done since launching the program. So it's really one of the great hypocrisies today in international foreign affairs, the open secret that is constantly being papered over and lives of omissions committed in its name.
What do you say? How do you unpack the term and the phrase "Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East"? It sort of reminds me of former UN Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick talking about South Africa as a partial democracy. White people could vote, black people couldn't.
Right. Well, you know, it's got some ring of truth to it, because everyone can see the Knesset, the elections, the constant, you know, aspirations to have a representative government. But then you've got all of these Palestinians who, outside of Israel, are subjected to Israeli control and yet have no votes. You have the Arab Israelis who do have a vote and some marginal rights, but not full representation. So, you know, I think it's a great slogan. And there are a lot of great slogans coming from Israel's lobby, such as "Only democracy in the Middle East," "The Middle East is being a dangerous neighborhood." The other trope, canard, is you know, Iran is the leading state sponsor of terrorism. What you never hear of, though, is Israel as the leading state sponsor of Middle East nuclear proliferation. Yeah, equally true. And you don't really get a sense that there is any other democratic manifestation in the region, or ever get a clear hearing of how the Palestinian Authority and other attempts at governance have really been imposed as authorities in the name of Israeli security rather than any meaningful democracy. So it's a problematic concept, but Americans are used to, I think, unknowingly receiving all sorts of propaganda slogans that really don't mean much at the end of the day.
What I don't understand is, how do those folks who work at the International Atomic Agency, these agencies that inspect, would inspect Iran, how do they explain that they never get to go to Israel? Anybody in that agency ever raised that issue?
Well, I can tell you, they fear for their budget. The International Atomic Energy Agency, or Commission, is constantly under threat of budgetary cuts if it doesn't ignore the Israeli program and allow the Israelis full access to all of its programs. So in the last round, APAC lobbying, that's the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, they were passing and working on specific legislation to defund and discredit the International Atomic Energy units of the UN, so that they would not receive continued U.S. funding if they do anything that would isolate Israel in any way. So they're not able to hold Israel accountable for this, and they pretty much have to admit that they're part of a flawed system that has, you know, this giant asterisk over all manner of enforcement. The Israelis are not subject to inspections. They're not a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and again, they have not admitted to having a nuclear weapons program.
All right. Well, Grant Smith, it is always very interesting talking to you. That's one of those issues in global affairs when we talk about peace in the world. peace right. in the Middle East. It is inexplicable. You know, I have to say, every time I hear about Israeli threatening to blow up Iran, maybe they threaten to nuke them if they ever dare to get a nuclear weapon. It seems to me this is a very obvious contradiction that makes a lot of people angry in the Middle East. And it would seem to me it's something we're going to have to get by, or there will never be peace in this world. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right, Dennis. And it really does, you know, give credence to the fact that if there is going to be any sort of peace, the U.S. has to stop making deals with, again, authoritarian regimes in the region. You're going to have to deal with the Palestinians. You don't make peace.
That's right.
You know, with bystanders. So I'm glad that you're continuing to keep on this topic.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We're out of time. Grant Smith, thank you. He is the director of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy. Stay safe. We're out of here.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.